This conference is being recorded.
Okay, did everybody hear that?
Yeah.
Good. All right, so we'll get started with Jim Bergman. Jim is the director of the Smoke-Free Environments Law Project in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and been working on smoke-free housing for a long time and been a leader in this area. What I'd like to start out with is maybe have Jim talk a little bit about how he's been so successful with housing authorities. How many housing authorities are working on or have implemented smoke-free policies in Michigan now, Jim?
We have 27 that have, since July of 2005, we've had 27 housing authorities or housing commissions adopt smoke-free policies here in Michigan. So we went from zero to 27 relatively rapidly.
So what have been some of the key things that you've done that have made you so successful in this area?
I think good looks is probably the key. But short of that, I think make one other point, and that is that right now, nationwide, as far as we know, there are about 89 housing authorities that have adopted smoke-free policies for some or all of their buildings. And what we've seen is just a really dramatic increase in the last, since January of 2005, we've seen 75 housing authorities adopt smoke-free policies. That's a 540% increase during that 45-month period, which is, so we're averaging almost two housing authorities a month around the country who are adopting smoke-free policies. Clearly, this has become a trend that is very dramatically increasing. And I think that the reason for our success here in Michigan, as well as I think the success around the country reason, or the key thing initially, was demonstrating that, yes, it is legal to adopt a smoke-free policy in not just public housing, but in subsidized housing as well as market-rate housing. Getting it, making clear that it is legal was crucial. The other thing was getting Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, to agree that it was, that it's legal, and that was a real barrier initially because HUD was being its typical self in having a variety of different messages it was sending out, sometimes saying, no, you can't, sometimes saying, yes, you can, but, and it was only when we got clarification that, yes, in fact, it was legal, and furthermore, that it was up to the local housing authority or the local apartment owner who had HUD-subsidized units. Once it was clear that HUD approved of it and that it was legal, that really opened the doors. And I think what we have found is that, by and large, housing authority directors really would like to do this, and many of them have wanted to do it for years. It was just that, again, HUD was just not being clear about what was whether it was could be done or not. And now that they are clear, and you have a letter out of the Denver office also saying that it's up to the local housing authority or HUD-subsidized owner to do what they want to as long as they comply with state laws and local laws, that really does open it up. The other reason, I think, is once we had made that clear, then we developed a really close working relationship with the housing authority director and with them, with their boards of directors. And I think it was truly establishing that we were knowledgeable, that we were trustworthy, that we were also not trying to shove anything down their throats, that we were there to work with them as partners, and that they were, the housing authority director and their boards were the ones who were calling the shot, not us, that we were there to assist. I think once we established that kind of relationship, then truly the housing authority director have been our the leaders in bringing us in with other housing authorities. So I think, again, it's legal and developing that kind of close working relationship. And I think then it really was just mutual respect. I've worked on housing for years and knew a little bit about it, but I think it was clearly just developing that mutual respect. The other thing is that most housing authorities most housing authority directors are very well aware of the additional cost that's involved in turning over an apartment when a smoker has been in there versus a unit that has not had smokers. And the estimates I hear are anywhere from $500 to $8,000 to $10,000 extra to turn over an apartment where you've had a smoker or multiple smokers. And that, you know, how bad it is depends on how long the smoker has been in there, how much they smoke, whether there's carpeting, whether there are curtains, a variety of things. But basically, this is a cost issue. And I know for health folks working in the health field, this is very much a secondhand smoke health issue. And certainly the directors and their boards recognize that and are sympathetic to that as well. But housing is a business. Whether it's public housing, subsidized housing, or market rate, it's a business, and you've got to be able to fill those units, and you have to be able to operate them without losing money. Having smokers in there is a money loser, not a money maker. So I think that was very crucial. The other thing was the multi-unit housing industry truly has made a dramatic change in attitude on this. Two or three years ago, the multi-housing field was not in tune with adopting smoke-free policies, largely because they didn't think it was legal, and second, because they thought that it would be too much of a hassle and that it might be too risky. Now the National Apartment Association has had, as many of you know, the December 2007 issue of Units magazine, which the National Apartment Association puts out, did a cover story on this in 10 pages of articles. They basically said this is not just a good thing for health, this is a good business decision. Likewise, the National Multi-Unit Housing Council, their name, but basically group that works with affordable housing operators has also endorsed this as a wise move. So the multi-unit housing industry is now on board on this and is saying this is a smart idea. NARO, the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, is having this on their program at their San Antonio conference this month. And again, basically, the multi-unit housing industry is now saying this is a smart idea, a smart business idea. All of those things, I think, are what has contributed to our success here in Michigan, but also to the success or the growth of the smoke-free policies all around the country. And I think the other thing that's been made us successful here in Michigan is we've worked extremely closely with the local health departments. They've been our partners on this, as has the state health department. So the combination of local partners and good relationship with the housing authority director has been, those have been the keys, I think, for us.
Jim, one of the things I remember that you wrote me many eons ago, and I want to focus more on housing authorities for this call again. One of the things I remember you mentioned that when you first got started, it started all out with one housing authority director that was really passionate about the issue and really wanted to help you get your name out and also maybe talk a little bit about how you got into conferences and how you've done a little work in terms of keeping the communication flowing with the different commissions in Michigan.
Okay. Yeah, our start on this really came from the housing authority director in Cadillac, Michigan, Dan Peterson. And Dan had wanted to do this for adopt a smoke-free policy for years, but the HUD office had kept telling him, no, you can't. And he learned about us, gave me a call, and we worked together for 6 months on getting his board to agree that they should adopt a smoke-free policy. Dan, the night that that policy passed, turned to me and said, Jim, thanks so much for all your help, and promise me one thing, that you won't stop here. And then he laughed and he said, because I don't want to be the only one that gets sued. But Dan really became a real close working partner on this. He, when he would get calls from other housing authority directors asking about how the policy would going, was going and how they'd implemented it, he immediately told folks, call Jim Bergman, and he'll work with you. You can trust him. So Dan was a real close working partner on this. Also, Linda LaFord's predecessor as director, Pat Shimmons, was the head of the Michigan chapter of NARO, and Pat was very much on board with doing this also. And I think the combination of Dan and Pat, both of them suggested that we do sessions at the semi-annual conference that NARO had here in Michigan, as well as we have another Housing Authority Direct Association in the state, and Dan suggested that we do a session there. So within a very short period of time, we did presentations at both of the statewide housing director associations, where I was one of the participants at one of them. Dan was the other presenter at the other one, Pat Shimmons, and one other housing director from Michigan, and I did the presentation. So the it was truly a matter of the Pat and Dan taking the lead on getting us involved with the associations, and they gave me credibility by saying this guy knows what he's talking about. And so I think the other thing we did was we also, probably every 6 months or so, I do a mailing to all of the housing authority directors here in Michigan, just updating them on what's happened in the past 6 months on adoption of smoke-free policies, what's going on around the country on it, and encouraging them to contact me if they want assistance on this. And that normally generates additional housing authorities that want to do it. A lot of it is just word of mouth as well. The housing directors that we've worked with will tell other housing directors when they get together that the policy is working well. And I think that's the other point. Since July of 2005, when the first policy was adopted in Cadillac, as I said earlier, 27 housing authorities here in Michigan have adopted policies. Nobody has reversed the policy. There have been no legal challenges to those policies. And from what I hear, and Andy and Linda will certainly talk about this, enforcement has not been any problem. Are there a few violations now and then? Yes, there are a few, but generally those get resolved quite simply. I know of no addiction anywhere in Michigan or anywhere in the country that has happened that was due solely to violation of smoking, the smoke-free policies. So basically it's been the housing directors have been very supportive of this, and they've been the ones who've been generating referrals for us. I also do some cold calling on housing directors around the state, and so do our local partners, and that also generates additional folks working on it.
Great. This is, I think those are great ideas, and many of those that I think we can adopt locally. I know we talked to somebody from the Boulder County Housing Authority a few weeks ago, and he indicated that they're extremely busy people, so anything we can do to help them is helpful. Let's go on and talk a little bit about how the process and implementation techniques and enforcement strategies. I'm sure we'll get some of that as well from Linda and Dan. But anything you want to mention about that, Jim?
I think a couple of points, Pete. One, you just mentioned how busy housing authorities are and directors are. That, I think, is a major barrier. It's one that can be overcome, but we have to recognize that housing authority directors have got a heck of a lot of stuff on their plate, and taking on an issue like adopting a smoke-free policy is viewed by most directors as being something that's going to take some time, and they really raise the question of, do they have the time to take this on? And you have to respect them on that one, that if they say, I've got my plate is absolutely full right now, I'd love to do it, respect what they're saying. When they're ready, they'll do it. But if they got their plate too full, pushing them too hard is not going to be helpful. These are folks that have got a hell of a lot of work to do, and smoke-free policies generally are not on the top of the list initially, but they will be. The other thing is that what we have found, is, or one of the things that I always emphasize, is that the market is huge for smoke-free housing, and right now the demand is much greater than the supply out there of smoke-free housing. One of the things that's important to look at is the smoking rates within Colorado. And as you know, your adult smoking rate is about 20%, give or take a percentage point or two. And for the elderly population, the 65-plus, smoking rate is less than 10%. You need to emphasize that in talking with housing authority directors and their boards. The other thing is take a look at your low-income population smoking rates and your ethnic smoking rates. What you'll find generally is that, yes, they are slightly higher, but they're not a lot higher. Generally speaking, 25-30% smoking rate among persons with income would qualify them for public housing or other subsidized housing. That's not much different than the regular adult smoking rate, but you need to put that out there because the perception often is that the smoking rate is much higher than it actually is. And that's also why we encourage housing directors to do a survey of the buildings that they have to get a sense of how many smokers they've got in each building. Sometimes some of those buildings are de facto smoke-free already. In terms of strategy, we usually suggest, as I just said, that housing authority directors do a short survey of the residents to find out how many smokers there have and whether they would approve or disapprove of a smoking policy. That helps identify whether you've got some folks who are going to be very vocal in opposing the policy, but it also makes sure that there is input by the residents so that they don't feel that this was just dumped on them without their having a say. The other thing is we do encourage having presentations done beforehand so that the residents have an opportunity to hear somebody talking about the reasons for this and for them to be able to ask questions. Certainly in public housing, you've got to do the provide that opportunity for residents to speak to the about a policy change anyhow. The other thing is we do encourage the local health department to work with the housing authority to make available smoking cessation opportunities for residents. But once the policy has been adopted, what we normally suggest on the policy is adopt the policy saying that it'll be effective for all new residents and all current residents who are not smokers, as well as guests and housing authority staff, and that they simply adopt that policy, pick a date for it to be effective, the same day or a month out after it's been adopted, and then pick a date for how long current residents who are smokers will be grandfathered. Grandfathering only has to be for as long as the state law requires that you give notice for a lease change. And on this one, we generally suggest a grandfathering period of 3 months, 6 months, maybe 12 months, but certainly we don't recommend grandfathering for as long as people live there, because that does not get rid of the secondhand smoke problem, it doesn't get rid of the maintenance cost problem, and it simply prolongs things. And it can mean that a smoke-free building would not be smoke-free for another 20, 30 years. What we've seen is that by and large, housing authorities more and more are now not grandfathering for as long as people live there, but are doing it for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, something like that. And that's what both Linda and Andy's housing authorities did. I think that may answer what you were asking.
Great. We have about five more minutes if you have anything else to add before we open it up to questions.
I don't think so.
Okay. So let's go ahead and open up the lines for questions. Does anybody have any questions for Jim?
This is John from Denver. I have a question.
Go ahead.
You had mentioned, and I'm not familiar with it, I might have it, but I don't think so, a magazine article or something that had like 11 pages to it?
Yep, and PETA's got copies available and he could get out to you. It was a real good set of articles. One of our staff attorneys wrote some of them. It's a good piece, and as I said, Pete's got copies he can get to you.
The units article on the trend towards smoke-free housing.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
This is Jan Morcheski, and I have a question.
Go ahead.
I just want to address the difference in rates that you mentioned, and I think it's really important. Most of the calls that you that we get are from elderly people who want to be protected or people with kids. However, in Larimer County, our tobacco, our adult tobacco use rate is down around 14%, and people living in poverty or Latinos is still twice that. So it's still an issue for us where it is. We haven't been able to impact those rates as much as we should, so it is still double. But I think at the same time, turning it around and saying that about 75% of people living in poverty don't smoke still works. But I just wanted to point out that our rates of persons living in poverty are still about double as our general rate.
Yeah, I think I agree with you that that is the case. But I think that this is a little bit, or at least in my view, it's a little bit like asking high school students how many of your classmates smoke. And as you know, frequently...
And it's everybody.
Yeah, everyone smokes, or
yeah.
It's 75%.
Right.
When we know the reality is about half of that.
Right.
Less. So I think that here again you've got a situation where oftentimes perception and reality are not the same. So I think it's important to just put those numbers out there and then when the if they do the housing director does a survey within the buildings, they'll get a better sense of where their population is. And certainly, if you've got elderly disabled housing, folks who are there's a higher smoking rate generally among the disabled. So you may have elderly housing or housing that's a combination of elderly and disabled, and you may have a low smoking rate among those older people, but a higher one among the disabled. So you get a mix in there, but I think the main thing is to right up front address the issue of the perception may be very different from the reality.
Right.
When we worked with First Centrum, which was a large affordable housing private company that has over 50 buildings in 7 different states, I talked with them, and all of their housing is elderly. And I kept on saying to them, you know, I'm betting that your smoking rate is below 10%. And they came back with, no, you're nuts. It's got to be 25, 30, maybe even 40%. Well, they went out and surveyed their buildings. What they found was that about 4 to 6% of their residents were smokers. They adopted a smoke-free policy for all 50 of their buildings. They were the first large apartment development and management company in the country to adopt a smoke-free policy. The reason they did it was they discovered they had very low smoking rates, and at that point they said, hey, we know this is a good idea from a cost perspective. We just thought we had much higher rates of smokers.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, and I wanted to also add to that, if I may, Jim, is that the number of surveys that have been done in disparate populations is that it shows that they are just as supportive or more supportive for smoke-free policies, and some of them are more affected with secondhand smoke.
That's a good point. That also reminds me that one of the other points that I always emphasize is that having a smoke-free policy in a home is the norm in this country. Probably around 75 to 80% of households report that they have a smoke-free policy in their own home. And one of my favorite lines is that when you can validate that just by driving down the street in the middle of winter and you see somebody standing outside smoking a cigarette, that's not a nature lover. That's somebody whose family has said you can smoke, but you got to take it outside. A lot of smokers also, as you just said, would prefer not to have smoking in their own home because they don't like the smell of it either. So, but I think it's important to point out that this is the norm. It's not an aberration. It's not anything radical. The issue is if you live in multi-unit housing, you can have a smoke-free policy but still have secondhand smoke in your unit because your neighbor smokes, and that's the reason for going for the smoke-free policy.
Do we have other questions? Anybody else?
I have a question. This is Susan from Jefferson County Health, and thank you so much. This is so helpful getting this information. One of the things that I and I know some other people have been experiencing with some of the units that have gone smoke-free and we're wanting to, in fact, I wanted to do a press release and do, you know, make a big thing out of it, or share their survey results or let others know that they had gone smoke-free in the hopes that others would follow suit. But they've been very reluctant to be out there. It's almost like they want to stay under the radar screen that they're doing it, but it's a real wait and see. This is one area they do not want to be seen as a leader in because they're afraid of the backlash. And I'm wondering if this was something that you experienced or what some of the strategies that you all did.
Yeah, I think we are seeing that happen. But it varies. When Sault Ste. Marie Housing Authority, Housing Commission adopted their smoke-free policy, and Linda will mention this, I'm sure, almost immediately they put it on their website that this was that their elderly buildings were smoke-free, and they listed it as an amenity, just like having internet access was an amenity. My experience is that, yes, folks are cautious about this one. They think it's a good idea, but they're not at this point totally sure that it's a selling point. And generally, I think a lot of apartment owners and housing authorities would prefer to get somebody to consider applying, and then they can say, well, here are some of our rules. But I've also seen that, and I think we're going to see this increasing, that leaders in the field are saying this is an amenity. It's a good marketing thing for us, and we should emphasize it. My guess is that in the next few years, most folks will put this out there very visibly once they become convinced that it, in fact, is an asset for them. But folks are cautious.
Yeah, I think it will be helpful, excuse me, now that we have our Colorado Guide to Smoke-Free Housing up on the Internet, to mention that there are now 127 multi-unit communities that are totally smoke-free in Colorado with more than 6,000 units in them. And that will help make people realize that they aren't the first ones, that there are many people that have already adopted it or are in the process of adopting smoke-free policies.
This is Sandra Colley in Castilla County. I just have a quick question.
Go ahead.
How do you overcome the barrier of the cost of converting a heavy smoker unit to a non-smoking unit? Because that's the one barrier I've heard a lot is, well, it's going to cost us to replace the curtains, the carpet, the paint, the so on and so forth. So what do you suggest to them? Do you just simply say, well, it's still going to be less in the long run?
Yeah. You're going to have to do it sometime. And the longer the person smokes, the more it's going to build up in there. And actually, you might want to ask that question or have Linda and Andy address that question because I don't know for sure what they have done in turn once they, because they did grandfather just for a limited time period. They can maybe address the question of do they then go in after that policy has been adopted and clean up that unit where the smoker lives, or do they just leave it until the person leaves and then go in and clean it up? I'm not sure on that one, but otherwise we are not seeing people move out generally because of the smoke-free policy. Occasionally, one or two people might leave and say that they won't, but basically, this is good housing and the price is right. They're not going to do any better, so you don't get many people leaving. So I really haven't heard that issue come up with housing directors. I think they've just assumed that they're going to have to clean it sometime.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
This is Shiloh in Pueblo County, and I just have a question about the presentations that you were saying you suggest doing with the residents ahead of time. And I was just curious who you had do those presentations. Was it the health department or somebody from the apartment?
Generally, I'll do them if I've got the time to do it, or the local health department person who works on tobacco issues will go in and do it. And the presentation normally talks about the reasons why a policy like this would be adopted in terms of health issues, but I also address the cost issues. But it's also an opportunity for the residents to ask questions. And I think that the value of that is, again, that gives the residents an opportunity to voice any concerns, any objections. And my approach is always to be extraordinarily respectful of whatever they say, even if I've got somebody who's really angry about this.
Right.
You know, just be respectful. They have a right to their opinion. You may not agree with it, but be respectful. Give the facts. If they say, well, this isn't fair, why should you be doing this to me? And I'm very upfront about this, that yes, in fact, somebody's lifestyle is going to be changed because of this. On the other hand, there are other people who are affected by secondhand smoke, and there's not a thing we can do about it because we can't control where the secondhand smoke goes. So are we going to restrict some behavior that wasn't restricted before? Yes, we are. But the alternative is that other people's health is being harmed, and the costs to the housing authority are going up because of this. So, but, yeah, I normally do it, or local health department tobacco control staff.
When the health department did the presentations, did they ever come up against the anti-government problem? Like, we're working with the housing authority here, and we just completed a survey, and a lot of people who are against the policy are just because there's too much government involved.
Yeah, that comes up, and again, you just confront it the way you would any time, and that is, yes, we are talking about restrictions, but we're doing it because of the health issues involved and because of the cost issues. But, again, we're not saying you can't smoke. We're simply saying because you can't control where that smoke goes and the physical damage that it causes, we're going to have to restrict where you do it. If you want to continue to smoke, you can. You can go outside in a designated smoking area, or if there's nowhere on the grounds, you can go smoke off the grounds. But, yes, you're going to be restricted, but the analogy I usually use is that there was a time when we allowed homeowners to let their raw sewage go out in lakes and rivers, and now we don't allow that anymore because we know it's a health issue and it's a serious one. Same thing with secondhand smoke. Yes, we do have laws, and they restrict behavior, but if there's a good reason for those laws, then we do them.
All right, folks, that session is now over, and we need to move on to the next guest. So thank you so much, Jim, for your time. You're welcome to stay on and comment as we go along. So once again, I ask for participants to mute your phones for the next 20 minutes or so. And our next guest is Linda LaFord, Executive Director. And how do you pronounce the name of your housing commission?
That would be Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan.
Okay, great. Thank you. And from what I understand, you adopted a smoke-free policy in December 2006 and for three elderly disabled apartment buildings of about 120 units. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the process of how maybe we should go back. Why did you feel you needed to do this and then the process that you went through to do it?
Yeah, without sounding redundant and repeating Jim did such an excellent job, it's almost going to repeat some of what he already said. But this began back in 2005. We started looking at this. One of the big issues is one of our units that we had that were 20 units in the building, and we kept getting complaints about secondhand smoke and the smell going through the building. We spent an enormous amount of money putting an exhaust system on top of the building, which in turn did not help at all. So that was $30,000 down the drain. And then just changing over the air exchange or the air exhaust fan in the bathrooms, we assumed it was coming through there. So we rerouted some of that. That still didn't work. So then it began to be costly to us. The more and more we kept looking into it, the more and more we kept thinking, we just need to go to no smoking. When the health the health issue became so rampant through the Sioux about the health issues, we thought it was just time. And that's exactly how we approached it. The money-wise, the subsidy is going down throughout public housing, so we needed to also find a way to save money. Turnover for a smoker is huge. When you go in and clean, you're not only cleaning, you may have to clean the walls before you can paint. If you don't clean it well enough, you can't paint unless you prime it. Just the fixtures, the time that it would take maintenance people to do the light fixtures, the switches, the all the switch plates throughout, the cabinets inside and out, it took a long time to clean that. So it almost doubled your maintenance time. So when we looked at the health issue, we looked at the complaints, we looked at the cost involved in cleaning everything, it was time. The first thing we did was put out, we contacted Jim and Julie, who is from our local health department, and helped us facilitate or how we should approach this. We went through and did a resident survey was the first thing we did. Amazingly, they were great. There were very little smokers to begin with, so they weren't resistant to it. Yes, we had a few of them. But then we went on and we brought the information to our board. Along with that, Jim and Julie started they have a Michigan Smoke-Free Apartment Initiative, the New Frontier. They presented this to our board. At the same time, we have our tenants, residents were present, and we got to answer questions between the board and the residents. So the board got to hear some resistance. And yes, we did hear. I had a non-smoker say to me, gee, if it's today, if it's smoking, what's tomorrow going to bring? This is my apartment. So Jim was very good about helping them understand this isn't about you not able to smoke. This is talking about not smoking within your unit. You can smoke outside the building, in which we have designated areas that can do so, but we just don't want you smoking inside the unit because of health issues. And because the subsidy is not going to be there very much longer. If the subsidy isn't there, what's going to happen to you in your apartment anyway? So we needed to find a way to balance this. And Jim did do an excellent job. I would recommend him to come to you anytime if he has the time. We looked at our carpeting. We have carpeting throughout. It was consistently being burnt. Now, I know it's other housing commissions, and they're going to say to me, you can go after the tenant to recoup that cost. You're only allowed to recoup so much. And if they don't have the money to get the money back, you can't recoup any of it. So we looked at the bigger picture of trying to save money. Let's give the residents their choice to smoke, but just not in their unit. They can go outside the building. We've had a no smoking policy in our community areas for a very, very long time, as long as I've been here, which is 20 years. So it was okay for them. The next step we took after we got the results, took the results to our board, we did up a resolution, the board approved it, January we put it in place, we put that information on our application at that time and asked them if they were a smoker. Some said yes, and of course the application is one for all, whether it be family or senior. The family's had a tough time with it, saying, are you going to go smoke-free for the family? At this time, we are not, but that doesn't mean we're not going to look at it in the near future. But the seniors, if we would tell them, yes, you smoke, and they would say, can we smoke outside the building? Absolutely. We have designated areas. They had no problem. We had no problem with leasing our units because of a no smoking. A lot of times they were saying, thank God there's some place in the Sioux to go that there's no smoking in the building, period. We chose to not grandfather them in just because of the reasons Jim had spoke about. What we had done was January 1st, we became a no-smoking building, and then we used 3 months later, which was our fiscal year, happened to be April 1. At that point in time, it was a smoke-free facility. I probably put out 4 or 5 lease violations since we began this. They're working really hard with their doctors and the health department to quit, but they still have a difficult time. And most of these aren't seniors. They were disabled people. So they also had a hard time getting outside to smoke. Regardless, it was still policy. They signed the new policy and got the new smoking policy. They signed for it April 1st, so they knew what could happen should they continue to smoke in their unit. Boy, you've done so much for me, Jim. I don't want to repeat myself.
You're doing great.
Let me ask you, is this a project-based housing commission?
I have one high-rise building that has 60 units in it. I have another mid-size, which has 20 units in it. And then I had quads, flexes.
But it is HUD-subsidized, some of those?
Yes, we're public housing authorities.
You don't get a HUD subsidies or Section 8?
We are HUD.
Oh, you are HUD. How did you go about in terms of implementing the lease? Did you have to change the rules or do an addendum? What was the process that you used there?
We did an addendum to the lease. We had a no-smoking policy with the addenda. And come April 1st, we notified all of our... They knew in January it was going to happen. We sent out the notice saying it happened, and that come April 1st, a lease addendum with the no-smoking policy would be enacted and that they must come in to sign the lease addendum and pick up the no-smoking policy, which everyone, 120 of our residents in our senior sites, did so and signed with no problem.
Right. And what are, in terms of, you mentioned that you had a few issues with some people. What are some of the enforcement strategies that you've used?
They're pretty good about calling me should there be any problems, and if they can smell smoke in the building right away, either I will go over there or the maintenance department goes over there to try to determine who it is. Normally you know who they are because you knew beforehand. So we went and knocked on their door. You have to be very sensitive in the beginning but strong that you know you signed the policy, you know you could lose your lease, and you know there's designated areas. You need to take it outside. Most of them were very apologetic. They thought that they could get by with one. It was too cold out. They didn't want to go outside. Now some of them say they don't even bring them in from their car, because if they're in their car, they have to go out and have a cigarette in their car, which is better yet. Now, I haven't had a lease violation regarding smoke probably in the last 6 months.
Right. How about the question that somebody asked earlier about, once you made your policy, did you go into some of the units that where their smoking was allowed and do anything in terms of, cleaning it, especially, or did you just wait until did any of them get vacated after the policy got changed and you then cleaned it up so it would smell less or et cetera?
No, we decided not to go into the unit after April 1 and clean it because there were still going to be those moments, because realistically you have to think it's going to happen. So we wanted some time to go by to see how it was going to filter out, and we decided not to go ahead and turn that unit completely over to get the smoke and the residue out of it until the tenant vacated. And the tenant has not vacated yet, so I couldn't really tell you. I know from past experience working here that when maintenance would go in to any unit where they smoked, it cost almost double because of the fact of wiping everything down and priming the walls and the ceilings and such to repaint it. But no, we haven't turned those units over since the tenant is still living there that smoked there at one time, so we decided not to do that.
Well, I mean, if you did have a unit that became open and where you did have a smoker previously, even though it's now smoke-free, would you do anything like that?
Yeah, we would definitely go in and prep it just like we would do any other unit. We would go in and prime it, clean it, repaint it. We may have to replace the carpet, We clean all of our carpets anyway when a tenant moves out. But you never know if you can get it out. Sometimes there's some of the cleaners, they have these cleaners that you can. But if they did, a new tenant would go in and said that they were still having a reaction to it or they could smell it, then we would go back in and tear the carpet out and put new in.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you.
This is John. I have a question.
We'll go ahead and open it up for questions now. Before we go to questions, is there anybody else that joined us on the call that did not introduce themselves, came in late? All right, great. We'll go ahead and open up for questions. Go ahead, John.
I have had people call and say that they're having smoke coming in, and I've gone out to their units, and I can't tell it, but somehow, some way, they can. What do you do in those cases?
They can say it. I'm trying to be real sensitive here. They can say it all they'd like, and sometimes they smell that, and it's truly not it. It may be something else. Until you really notice it, and you go there, or your maintenance person goes there, there's not much you can do. It's like any other policy trying to put into place or enforce. Unless you see it, you smell it, you're aware of it, there's not too much you can do about it.
Jim, you have any thoughts on that?
Nope.
Okay.
I think Linda's absolutely right. It's just like some other policy violations. If you can't prove it, you can't do much about it.
Yeah, I think John's perspective is that he's got complaints from residents and he's gone through their homes to check it out and he can't detect anything. I think that, is that right, John?
Yeah, I've had a couple that are like that, and I've had one whose wife had a stroke, and they're concerned that the smoking that they're perceiving that's coming into the unit might complicate her health even further. And in my head, I'm hearing the word lawsuit, because they keep complaining about this, and they keep saying it's happening, and they keep leaving the unit because they say it's overwhelming, and I've gone in, and I'm like, I don't smell anything. So I'm just wondering, is there some device, or should I bring in somebody who's more sensitive to smell than I am, who might be able to say, well, yeah, I smell this. Because I can go through and not smell anything for days. So
I guess I would only put into that is make sure you've documented it, did anything and everything possible that you could to satisfy the tenant. If it was bringing in a help from the health department, an official over there, to come in and view or see it or smell it, great, document. Document every time that you've been in that unit that the tenant called you with that concern. You brought a maintenance staff person with you. You brought another person with you. And at any point in time, you could not see it, smell it. I would just document that file a little heavy. I don't think you'd get in trouble for that one.
This is Joanne. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, sometimes people with disabilities have a really high sense of smell, and they can pick up smell that other people cannot. So it could be that you can't pick up that smell, and they're very sensitive and they can. So that could be a possibility.
Exactly. You just bring in another party in to help see the smell, or see if they can smell it or not, and just document that you did that. Bring in another health official. I don't know of anything, Jim, do you, that you could put in a unit that says it's there?
No, I don't. And we've looked whether there are devices that could be used to measure this, and there are certainly devices out there that have been used when folks have been working to get smoke-free workplaces like restaurants and bars, but the folks that I've talked to who are the real authorities on this have said that they don't, number one, those devices probably are not going to work in an apartment setting, and the devices are also very expensive, like $20,000 possibly. So I don't know of anything that you can use for a measuring device, and you'd have to go in and get a baseline measurement first with no smoke so that you'd have something to measure against. A number of us have played around with this one, but so far we really haven't come up with any measuring device that would do it. So you're sort of left with the old sniff test, which is obviously imperfect, but the only other thing would be to ask the resident to, the minute they smell it, call the office, and hopefully it's during the daytime, and see if somebody can get it out there right away. But short of that, I don't know what you can do about it.
Then you have to remember the chemical sensitivities.
Yep.
And actually, this is Jan, and at studies at National Jewish, they've used cotinine detectors, which are different than odor detectors, and I don't know if they're expensive, but I think the thing to remember in the discussion is, smell might be a way to detect a violation, but it's not a way to detect toxicity. So, I guess I have a question for Pete. When they've gone in, like at A&R to some of the casinos, what kind of at the A&R convention, and then we measure levels at casinos, what kind of detectors do they use? And are they, like you were saying, the expensive things? Are they detecting cotinine?
Well, Jim and I at the Minnesota conference attended a night session with several experts on how do you test for smoke intrusion in apartments. And as Jim mentioned, basically what they have to do is they have to put some kind of device outside of the unit.
Okay.
If the smoke is going outside or putting it in the hall. But there are certain things that they have to test for, and a lot of it has to do with nicotine and other kinds of gases, and it gets pretty complex. It's you have to be have a degree in physics to understand it. It was over my head. I don't know about you, Jim, but
yep.
it was kind of intense. But I think in a nutshell, they're looking into some less expensive ways. What they use with casinos and others is these air packs that can measure, but that wouldn't work in an apartment setting because with those air packs, you have to actually be in the place and you have to be testing the air right there, and that's not going to always work for an apartment or a condo setting.
The cotinine stuff, even there, you'd be testing the resident who was complaining, but there would still be a question about if they do detect the cotinine level is high enough, where did it come from? Was it from the next-door neighbor, or was it that they were out shopping somewhere and they encountered smokers there? So that also would be a very imperfect one.
And they did come up with a graph of different devices that could be used, but as Jim said, it's very expensive. They're looking into a less expensive device, but I think they're still testing whether that will work or not.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any questions for Linda?
I just wanted to add, Pete, when they talked about the advertising, we went into effect January 1 of 2007, and they hit our front page on January 8, 2007, so we didn't waste any time advertising it.
I should also tell you, by the way, that a couple of weeks after Sault Ste. Marie Housing Commission went smoke-free in those buildings, I got a call from an affordable housing manager saying that he wanted to know whether he could adopt a smoke-free policy. And when I asked him why, he said, well, we have one building in Sault Ste. Marie, and my manager there is getting calls from elderly folks, and the first thing they ask is, can I smoke? And he said, my fear is that the Sault Ste. Marie Housing Commission is going to get the reputation of being the sweet-smelling, no-smoking buildings, and my place is going to be known as the stinky, smelly smoking buildings. And he said, and I'm going to get all the residents that I don't want who are going to drive up my maintenance costs. So it was an interesting thing, but a competitor viewed this as putting them at a disadvantage and putting the Sault Ste. Marie Housing Commission at quite an advantage in terms of getting the kind of residents that you'd want.
And two more private owners did go smoke-free this year up here.
That's right.
Does anybody have any questions for Linda that's on the phone? Any participants want to ask Linda some questions?
This is Richard Breidenbach. with Gasp of Colorado. I was trying to hit my mute button to be able to talk, and I accidentally cut myself off.
Okay.
Anyway, I wanted to make a comment about something that was just a couple minutes ago. I've been working with smoke-free housing for probably 11, 12 years. And different people have extremely different sensitivities to the smoke in their units. And sometimes when they call up and say that there's smoke in their unit and they want somebody to come over, by the time they come over, the smoke might be less, and also the person that's detecting it might have drastically less sensitivity to the smoke. Also, I think I read recently in one of the articles sent around on the listserv that there was a detector for checking nicotine in the dust in the unit. I was wondering if anybody else remembers that and has any comments.
I'm not aware of it.
And I don't remember it either.
Before we move on, just in case there's some people who are having trouble getting back in, I just want to remind you to mute is star 6 and to unmute is star 7. Does anybody have any other questions for Linda or Jim?
Pete, this is Jill. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I did have a question for Linda. You were talking about you had, when you were mentioning the violations, you had somebody that was trying to get help. When you announce your policy, is there anything you do to link them to resources that they can get to help quit?
Yeah, I guess I should have clarified that a little bit better. When we started out in this adventure with the surveys and that, the local health department helped us put a packet together, and it was a large, large packet, and it gave them quite a bit of information and contact names of who they could even speak to at the health department to get help, to talk to their doctors or to get help with prescriptions and such if they needed that. So when we did that, we made sure that all of our residents that in the senior buildings got that packet.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Well, Linda, thank you for being on the call with us. As we mentioned earlier, I'm aware that you're probably very busy, and I appreciate you taking your time.
You're most welcome. If they have any questions, Jim knows how they can get a hold of me. I can give them a copy of the surveys or the resolutions and specifics of what I give them to our board.
Great.
Okay?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy?
Good morning, everyone. I hope it's morning where everyone is at.
It is still morning here.
It's still morning.
All right. Well, I was preparing for this.
I'm going to ask everybody to mute their phones again for the next few minutes, and
okay.
Go ahead.
As I was preparing for today's presentation, I looked back on a news article that came out almost immediately after we came up with the policy. And one of my residents says, I figured it was coming sometime soon. In the last 10 years, everything has become non-smoking. I personally don't have a problem going outside. And I think that really resonates the attitude of our residents once we were able to get this in place. But let me digress a little. Let me go back and talk a little bit about Napa Housing Authority and then how we got involved. And I'll just kind of go from there. And if y'all have questions, just stop me anytime.
Where are you located in Idaho?
I'm located in Nampa, Idaho, where I guess you would call it a bedroom community to our city, our capital city, which is Boise. We're approximately 20 miles away from there. We're the second largest city in the state of Idaho with a population of roughly 85,000, 86,000. That number's kind of fluctuating right now, as you can imagine. NHA, or Napa Housing Authority, came into existence in 1951, and we built the first 75 units of our 142 portfolio. In HUD terms, we're considered a small PHA, or a small public housing agency. We have 142 units at 9 scattered sites throughout the city of Nampa. And to understand our city, we're probably about 5 minutes away from any one of our given sites. We're not a great big geographical type of city. So when we talk about city, y'all probably think towns if you're from big cities. We are a HUD-funded public housing agency, and so we have to work within the guidelines of HUD. I was approached by Mitch Keister here from the Southwest District Health Department early in the spring of 07, and he was talking to me about smoking and whether he could do a survey or not. And I'm an ex-smoker, but I'm not by any stretch of the imagination a born-again non-smoking zealot. I'm not one of those that turns my nose up to people when I walk past them and they're smoking. On the contrary, I take a little whiff because I still like the smell of smoke, even after 12 years this month, by the way. The bottom line is, I guess, what I would tell anyone who's interested in doing this is, as a smoker, I was used to getting pushed out. I remember being able to smoke at my desk. Then some employee there at the Capitol building in Boise darn near lit the whole place on fire because she had put a cigarette butt that wasn't quite out in a trash can, and so it burned part of our Capitol. And so that put a quick end to smoking at our desk. And I did a lot of travel at that time, so I remember smoking on the plane and how I would either get to the back of the plane where all the smokers were at and smoke, or else I would, make my travel around my cigarettes. So I know the strength of smoking and how hard of a habit it is to break. And so I was a little hesitant, to be quite honest, at the initial discussions with Mitch, although I thought, that this is good from a fiscal standpoint. I don't care about the health side of it. Everybody knows secondhand smoke is bad. Everyone knows that smoking kills you. Everyone knows that Joe Camel is, the folks' way of advertising to the next generation of smokers. I don't think anybody would dispute that. But I looked at it more from a fiscal standpoint. When we go into a unit of a smoker, we had to purchase a fogger, that's F-O-G-G-E-R, which costs approximately $1,000 plus the consumables that go into it. There's some little magic pill kind of thing they stick in there and end up getting rid of some of the smoke smell. But it doesn't get rid of the nicotine stains on the walls. And so we had to purchase a power washer in order to clean off walls and ceilings. And our air ducts need to be cleaned out professionally. We apply kills, and then we repaint. And this can be in a unit that has been that has had resident in it for even less than a year, simply because of the nicotine staining and the smell. So when I looked at this whole policy, my whole thing was, yeah, it's costing me a lot of money. Plus, that next renter sometimes would turn away the apartment, meaning more work for my occupancy staff, because they'd say, yeah, this one stinks like smoke, even though we would try to do everything we could to get the smoke out. Our first step after meeting with Mitch was the development of the actual survey that we sent out to our residents. I wanted their input. And so we sent out this survey that was mutually, the questions were jointly come up with by both Mitch and myself. And we sent out this survey. I think Jim was involved in that part too. I don't know what Mitch all did on that end. But the surveys were sent out, and we received 59 of them back, 42 of them from non-smokers, 19 from smokers themselves, which in the world of statistics makes for a really nice universe. It's a big number of smokers and non-smokers and people in general to respond. The questions that we asked were varied, and they were questions like, which of the statements best describe the rules, if any, about smoking inside your home? Your smoking is allowed anywhere in my house. Smoking is allowed in some places in the house. Smoking is always allowed inside my house. It asks questions like, is it okay for landlords to prohibit smoking in a renter's home? 57, by the way, said that was okay on all respondents. And only 18% said they disagreed. Those are probably the smokers. Another question that was very telling for us was the question that said, would you prefer to live in a completely non-smoking building, including individual apartments? Nearly 60% of the respondents said yes. And that was real telling. And so that's when I came back and I showed that to my board. And I said, look, here's an idea that we have about going smoke-free in all of our units. Because to me, if you're going to do it, you got to go all in. In my opinion, you can't kind of slowly phase it in. There's no reason for that. My board liked the idea so much that they started talking about a tobacco-free policy, which would include smoke-free or chewing tobacco and those types of things. But that was killed by those sort of more level-headed minds that said, you know, chewing tobacco, although it's gross and it hurts the person, doesn't affect the person around them unless they're spitting on the ground. And so we decided instead of passing a shotgun policy that sort of affected everyone, that we would just go ahead and pass the smoke-free policy. We did that at our August meeting, making it effective October 07. And then we did a grandfather piece to that for current residents who smoke to the end of the year of 12/31/07. The mindset behind that was that that's the time of year where a lot of us say, you know, I'm going to quit smoking, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to do more exercise and that sort of thing. So we just thought it was timely. And we also, when we went forward with it, we notified all of our residents and we notified them that we were going to be providing smoking cessation classes free of charge to them through Southwest District Health because they were the ones that hosted it at our community center. And so the individual that they brought in was just dynamite, I heard, and did a really good job of meeting with the folks and helping them get past the addiction. There was also a $200 grant, for lack of a better word, to purchase the quit smoking aids, whether it was Nicorettes or whether it was whatever nicotine gum or whatever that people could use if they were Medicaid eligible. So that was met very positively as well. And then at the end of the day, once the policy was put in place, Southwest District Health also paid for smoke-free housing signs that we posted at all of our units, which is the first thing people see. And I've been told by my occupancy staff that when people go out to look at our apartments, they say, oh, you're smoke-free. And then it enters into the conversation of, yeah, all of our units are smoke-free and whatnot. Concerns that we had from our point of view going into this were, first of all, was I going to lose any of my residents as a result of that, and what was the fiscal impact of that? The other was I going to be sued by Idaho Legal Aid or another group that helps individuals? But the legal aid issue came up, and I was at a meeting, and one of the Idaho Legal Aid attorneys goes to these meetings the same time as I do. And we were able to discuss it just kind of on, you know, one of those sidebar conversations that you have when there's a break in the action of the meeting. And I told him we were considering going smoke-free. And the telling thing that he told me was something I never thought about. But he said to me, Andy, you know you can discriminate against people, just not those who are under protected class. Individuals who smoke are not protected. And I figured, all right, well, I got the people who would likely sue me on my side, as it were. So I wasn't worried about the legal question anymore. I was concerned about an uprising by the residents. You know, I envisioned them picketing my parking lot and the negative press and all that stuff that scares the hell out of housing authority directors. But that never occurred. And the other concern that I had was cigarette butts. You know, when people smoke, they get rid of those little nasty cigarette butts, and they usually just flick them on the ground. But I do what I call a weekly walkabout in my units. I just walk around the units on the outside. If I see people out there, I'll stop and say hi and stuff. It's a way for me to interact with my residents in a way that's sort of me being on their turf, if you will. It's more comfortable for them, and it's not them coming into the office where they feel like they're coming into the principal's office kind of thing. And if I noticed that there were cigarette butts on the ground, I'd knock on the door if someone wasn't outside, and I'd ask them to clean up the mess, and I'd tell them by the time I leave the site, I want that cleaned up. And people were real responsive to that. People do recognize that they do have a good thing going here at the Housing Authority when their rent is being subsidized by HUD, and they're not paying market value rent out there. So they recognize that. And so that was an easy fix in terms of cigarette butts. And that's a continuing issue for me. As I go around the units, I'll sometimes see somebody who's getting a little sloppy with the cigarette butt can. It's getting overflowed or whatnot. And I just knock on a door. And to me, it's all about approach. You can go in and try to act like you are the authority, and that never works, or you can just say, you know, general reminder, which tends to work a lot better. The concerns that some of the residents had that were brought up to me were the obvious. Will I get kicked out if I get caught smoking in my unit? Could they smoke outside in general? There was some confusion as to how far they had to be from doors and whatnot, although it was specifically spelled out in the policy. They asked me if I would be a Nazi about the distance from the doors. And I said, look, you know, I'm going to be reasonable. I expect you to be reasonable as well. If your neighbor is complaining to you about the smoke, do the right thing. Go away from where they're at so that you don't continue to cause a problem. And I really only had a couple of occasions where that happened, and I was able to meet with both families at the same time and just lay down the law, if you will, and say, look, here's the deal. They don't want the smoke nearby. You're smoking too close. Fix it. Problem solved. It wasn't a matter of me having to go and serve an eviction or anything like that from individuals. I did have one violation, and I believe she sincerely thought that being grandfathered meant that that was forever and didn't realize that there was a cutoff date to that. And what I did with her is I said, look, well, you violated the lease. I have to do my job, too, but it doesn't mean I got to kick you out. So I had her sign what I call a lease addendum that basically says if you break the rule again, then you'll be immediately evicted from housing. You forego your rights to a public or to a formal hearing. You just go directly to court, basically. And she has since been smoking outside. The way that we handle any violations or the concern or the question that I heard earlier about, you know, how do you know someone's smoking? How do you know it wasn't there from before? It's a real easy fix if you have a central air, central heat kind of a system. And that is when my guys go in and change filters, you can tell when there's cigarette smoke in those filters and when there's not. And we did have one elderly resident who did continue to smoke, and that's how we found out about the one that I talked about that was in violation. So I can honestly say that we haven't had that turnover that I was concerned about. I can honestly say that we haven't had the huge number of violations that I envisioned happening. And we did get some really positive press out of it from our local newspaper. And they took the spin on it in terms of it being a good thing for the housing authority, it being a good thing for the families that live there. And so it wasn't a negative thing that could have easily been that way had we not gotten press early on, just like my colleague did as well. The one thing that I got that blew my mind, and it, to this day still perplexes me, is I was asked by one of my residents if they could continue to smoke. Now, this is a gentleman who is in his late 70s, who his idea of smoking is light the cigarette with the other cigarette that I just finished kind of guy. And he said, is there any way I can get a reasonable accommodation? Well, if anyone knows anything about fair housing laws, you don't say yay or nay on that. That's really not your call as to whether you think they can or not. And so I advised him to go to his health professional and tell him what his situation was and what we had done in terms of going smoke-free and see if his health professional would say, yeah, you should be granted a reasonable accommodation because of your health, so you don't have to go outside in sub-zero weather and smoke your cigarettes. And he signed one, which blew my mind that a health professional would do that. But nonetheless, he did, and I expected a flood of reasonable accommodation requests from smokers at that point. But it never happened. And so I've got this gentleman who still continues to smoke in his apartment because of the Fair Housing Act, which doesn't seem right, but it's, you know, I'm smart enough to realize I'm not going to take on legal aid when it comes to a fair housing issue. I won't have my name smeared for that. Another positive thing that came out of this, here in Idaho, this housing authority belongs to the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. And by the way, Jim, I'll be seeing you in San Antonio then.
Wonderful.
We also have our Idaho chapter, and our Idaho chapter isn't as active as it used to be, but we've started to become more active, and we're having an annual roundtable meeting in the summertime where we talk about policy and things that are coming down the HUD pipeline that are of concern to us. And so what our take is in the state of Idaho is that if, for example, they came down with a language assistance plan and there was, you know, we needed to have anyone who gets federal dollars needs to have a language assistance plan in place. So if any of y'all get federal dollars and don't, you're in violation. But we put together a language assistance plan that was exactly the same. So the Boise City Ada County Housing Authority has the same policy as I do, as does Southwest Idaho Cooperative Housing Authority, as does Twin Falls Housing Authority and Pocatello Housing Authority. Our mentality there is if HUD comes in and says it's wrong, then they have to get all of us for being wrong. If they say it's okay, then we all know we're okay. So instead of having all these little different silos of housing authorities, we're sort of more community-like when it comes to our policy and how we develop policy as a state. But in our roundtable meeting, We also mentioned best practices and things that we're doing that are kind of out there. Well, the Napa Housing Authority, in instituting the smoke-free policy, became the first housing authority in the state of Idaho to enact this policy. And as a result, my colleagues from either side of our borders in Idaho were calling me or were asking me some very specific questions about how we did it, what was the ramifications, was HUD okay with it, that sort of thing. And so I was able to talk to them about how we did this. And, you know, the same concerns that I had, they had, and I was able to let them know that they were nothing. They were able to come on board as well. Now, I don't know that they've gone smoke-free, but they're at least looking at it, and I've encouraged them to talk to their local district health departments to figure out whether they want to go with that or not. I've even had calls from as far away as Yakima, Washington, and the Yakima Housing Authority asking about this smoke-free policy and whether it was a good thing or a bad thing or whether that's something that they should pursue or not. I, of course, told them yes. And I will say that I pride myself on being an out-of-the-box kind of thinker and willing to do kind of crazy ideas, not for the sake of doing them, but simply because I think when we just continue to do the same thing, we become ineffective in our positions. And so I was very pleased to have interacted with Mitch on this and with Jim to get this done. And I was hesitant at first, I'm not going to lie, but I think that was quickly squelched in conversing with both Jim and Mitch and getting assurances that others had done it in other states and that although I was going to be a maverick in my state, it wasn't something that hadn't been done already. And so our comfort level went way up. And once that happens, of course, things really start to roll and things start to happen. So for us, it's been a positive thing. I've addressed the issue of people moving out that smoke after they move out. One thing we don't have is we don't have carpets except for in our 20 elderly units. And so that makes it a little easier to clean as well when we have to power wash and stuff. We don't have to worry about having to rip out carpet and put in new carpet. So that's been a blessing for us as well. But we've only had, I've had one instance where an elderly person moved out and we really, really had to go in there and just scrub the heck out of the walls and re-scrub and power wash and all that good stuff. But it's been a great deal for us, and I would strongly encourage any housing authority that's even remotely thinking about it to get on board and get her done, because it really is a benefit to the housing authority cost-wise and as well as marketing-wise. You know, people really dig the idea that we're a smoke-free apartment complex or we're a smoke-free project, and it helps us market our units even that much better.
Great, Andy. Let's go ahead and open up the lines for questioning. Anybody have any questions for Andy?
This is John from Denver again. This call has been very informative to me, and I'm wondering, would this have been something we could have invited housing authorities to participate in? And would it have been beneficial or a waste of our time?
I'm telling you, from El Paso County, I did do that. I invited a board member from the housing authority here, and I was going to go to her office to listen to this. And she sent me an email the other day that something else came up and she wasn't going to be able to do it. She is only a board member, and she has approached this topic with the president and with the executive director, and all of them have been told, she's been told by all of them to back off.
I just want to remind everybody that this call is being recorded, and so we will have it available. As we indicated at the very beginning of the call, is that I did invite several housing authorities. I also invited a couple of property managers. And as we indicated, these people tend to be extremely busy. And, you know, sometimes just getting a hold of them is tough. So, you know, with a busy schedule, we now have this recorded. So if they're still interested in listening to it, we should have the recording available. And they can, we should be able to get it through the STEP website, or we'll find some other way to get it to them.
But, Andy, this is Jill in Denver with the state office. And you talked about a housing collaborative that you're a part of.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if here in Colorado we can find those groups, and cause it sounds like hearing peer-to-peer is there's some that there's some buy-in that way, that or a way to get around some of the resistance if you approach them from through a collaborative like that.
You bet. And I actually think Jim going to San Antonio is going to really get a good audience, too, because there is a lot of folks that are looking into this, but they need assurance. I mean, you know, the last thing we want to do as executives in our organizations is do anything that's going to foul us up or that's going to make our board mad at us. And, I mean, that's the reality. But, you know, we will listen. I mean, I listen closely to my colleagues, like from Twin Falls and Boise when I came in and was a newbie, and I'm not that far away from being a newbie, by the way. When I first came in and didn't have a clue as to what HUD was or how regulations worked and stuff with respect to HUD, it was those colleagues that I relied heavily on for their input and for their advice on things that I was implementing here as a housing authority. And it's so true. I mean, these are folks that know the game, if you will. They've been in it 20-plus years. They know the rules. They know the regs. They know how HUD reacts to things. And so hearing from anyone else would be helpful to get people on board. And so I think if Jim, I know you're busy and I'll get out as well, but, you know, we have regional, NARO has regional arms to it and it has statewide arms to it. And so, I mean, if we could get into those organizations, then you'll get even, I think, more.
We did do a presentation on smoke-free housing here at the Colorado NARO conference last May. Together with the Boulder County Public Health Department, and you know, we had about 25 people there, and since then a lot of people have contacted us and worked with local health departments. But you know, one of the comments they said, it would be nice to have some people come that are in the industry or in a complex to share their successes. And I think their main concerns, which was, I thought was really interesting, were their concern about implementation and enforcement strategies. We have a few more minutes. One thing I hear a lot from people that have Section 8 apartments is, and that have to deal with HUD, is the whole issue of having to evict people. That sounds to me like it's a very strenuous process for housing authorities if they have to do that.
It's true. The only one that, or the only couple, like every state has their own different statutes on this, but the only two that are really easy across the board that I would say are drug-related offenses and non-payments of rent. Aside from that, you can have somebody breaking the rules and serve them, and you'll still be 3 or 4 months out before you get a court date. And so it is a big deal. You don't evict somebody just by giving them a piece of paper. That's just the beginning of the process. The process entails a court system that is overwhelmed anyway. And so you can be 3, 4, 5, 6 months out before you get a court date. Again, the rules are what they are. The Idaho state statute is quiet when it comes to landlords' rights with respect to their own property. But if the rule is there in place and they've signed a document indicating that they understand that, then it's an easy evict.
But you haven't had to go there.
Oh, no. The very last thing I want to do is go to court on anything. But when I'm evicting somebody, I let them know I've got everything in order to evict you, and that means I have everything ready to go to court. Because I won't just, on a whim, just serve someone an eviction notice. I need all the backup to it. And so I just tell folks, look, if you get served an eviction notice, it's because I know I can win in court. And I usually try to not go there with folks. So I try to tell them, look, I'm serving you this notice, but you've got 30 days to get out. I would take those 30 days and move out of this apartment complex and move out on your own so that it doesn't show as an eviction on your record. Because once I go to court, you're going to be evicted. And that'll always come up on your criminal and credit history report. And when they're asked for a landlord reference, I'll have to put in there that they were evicted, whereas if they move out before 30 days, they're not considered evicted. But I also let them know I'm not going to lie to the landlord. If they say, did you violate the lease, I'll say yes, but that you weren't evicted at the time.
Yeah, and if it goes on the record, it makes it harder for them to find Section 8 housing elsewhere, right?
Absolutely. We're tied nationally to a computerized system. So if somebody in Jacksonville, Florida, moves over here to Idaho and they got a bad reference from a housing authority over there, I'll get it here. And so there's no hiding from that. So if they've got an eviction from there, that comes up in the system, and they'll be denied here in Idaho, in Colorado, in Michigan, in Florida, or wherever.
Does anybody else have any questions for Andy? We've got a few more minutes, and then we need to wrap up.
Pete, I should mention, I don't know of any place in the country where there has been an eviction that's been based solely on the smoking issue, and I think we'd know. The other thing, you, folks may want to let your housing authority contacts in Colorado know about the NARO session that we're going to be doing on smoke-free multi-unit housing. The session is going to be on Tuesday, October 28th at 1:30 to 3 o'clock that day. And the speakers are going to, and I think I mentioned this because Andy said, you know, how important peer contact is. The guy who put the session together is Jim Ingalls, and Jim is the executive director of the Livonia Housing Authority here in Michigan, where they have adopted a smoke-free policy. But Jim is also a former national president of NARO. So this is somebody who clearly has the respect of his colleagues. And the other person is Elaine Wiseman, who is the executive director of the Kearney Housing Authority in Nebraska. And Kearney was the first housing authority that we know of in the country to adopt a smoke-free policy. And she did it back in 1996. So she's also well-respected by her colleagues. So I would suggest letting folk, your housing authorities, know that this session is going to be done on October 28th at 1:30 at the NARO conference and encourage them to go to it.
Yeah, Jim, why don't you send me an email about that, and we'll get that, try to get that out.
Okay.
Before everybody leaves, I just also want to mention that, you know, one of the things that was mentioned about this call is that a lot of the housing authorities in Michigan and across the country have basically adopted the same policies or similar policies to what NAMPA has adopted. And we have those policies on our website at GASP website, mysmokefreehousing.org, as well as a sample survey that they have taken and sample housing commission policy as well. And those are all from Jim. That Jim's developed and that has been used by many housing commissions. And we also have the Boulder Housing Authority survey on that website as well. Are there any final questions? We have a few more minutes here. Being that there's no more questions, I want to thank Andy, and I want to thank Linda and thank Jim for their time. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
And I want to thank Jim for helping me coordinate and get and making sure that Linda and Andy were on the call.
And let me, Andy and Linda also, thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Y'all take care.
Thank you. Very much.
Good
bye-bye.
Job.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please stand by.